there. Okay. This is the second in a series of interviews with Dr. Peter Greenwald, the director of the Division of Cancer Prevention in the National Cancer Institute, about the history of his division. We're talking on December 4th, 2008. The interviewer is Victoria Hardin. Now, Dr. Greenwald, when we stopped the last time, you were explaining to me why Vince DeVita's management style convinced you to leave New York for Bethesda when Arthur Upton's style did not. Would you begin this interview by describing Dr. DeVita as a physician, a scientist, and administrator?
Yes. Vince DeVita was a very strong scientist, particularly in the clinical area, having led in the development of therapies for Hodgkin's and other lymphomas. He also was a strong and dynamic leader in the sense that he would listen to input. He believed in openness and open advisory groups. He believed that unless you can convince an advisory group that this was a good direction, you might want to rethink yourself. But at the same time, he would make decisions and follow through on them, both about people and about programs. What Art Upton had been a very kind, wonderful scientist, but didn't like to be in the midst of debate and turf wars and such things. And so I was coming into a program that was the weakest at NCI, at the Division of Cancer Control. It was actually called Resources Centers and Community Activities. A lot of the staff there had been the weakest staff that had been pushed in by a committee that Bob Hoover and others were on. And they had interpreted cancer control, a term that Congress imposed on NCI in 1973, believing that NCI would not do cancer control unless they were required to do it by Congress. In other words, they wanted to see public benefit and not just discovery. The problem with that through the 70s was that the NCI staff, Diane Fink and others, defined that as not being research. So you could not do research on how you would apply knowledge. And the way they would do things is they'd sit around a table and decide this would be a good thing and put money into it. That was foreign to me and to other scientists. Both the research itself, the discovery, the clinical trials, and the follow-through on applications of research and research on the applications were all part of science. And that's what I wanted to do. So I needed to come in and change the whole climate and the whole staff. And I didn't feel I could do that under Dr. Upton, much as I liked him, a wonderful person. But I felt that with Vince DeVita's backing, I would be able to do that.
This is a broader theme within NIH in that period, too, is, if I recall correctly, the basic science versus targeted research and the push-pull as to where the money ought to go. Cancer just may have been a bigger focus because it had more money. And
we had a line item for cancer control.
Uh-huh.
And what was happening through the 70s and into the early 80s was the definition of cancer control was very fuzzy. People that wanted some of that money would say, cancer control is rehabilitation. Cancer control is something else. Spend the money on what I want. And it wasn't going anywhere. And I felt a big missing link was what you can do in cancer prevention. And what I saw was a lot of study of epidemiological associations, carcinogenesis, which was important, but it was more discovering relationships, was being defined as prevention when there was nothing in it that had to be doing something for public benefit. So etiology to me was knowing, prevention was doing with a scientific basis, and that's what I wanted to build.
Before we get into the details of what you were doing, I want one little side thing here. I want to note that when you were setting up this division, they named you as editor-in-chief of the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, and you served from 1981-1987. Now, did you seek this responsibility, or was it assigned to you? And would you explain to me how you managed to edit a major journal and run a division and set up at the same time?
Well, Vince DeVita mentioned to me it was open. I'd say I just, as I recall, said I'd love to do that. I felt several things. Number one, as an editor of a journal, you're forced to look at things that you might not pay attention to. And I felt that that helped you in getting a broad vision and being integrative in the way you thought about things. And I felt that was part of our role as leaders, as members of the executive committee of the National Cancer Institute. So I wanted to do it because I thought it would pull me away from my strong focus to a broader focus that would be a benefit. And able to do it, of course, it took longer hours, but there was very good staff, very good associate editors. And John Baylor was editor before me and had actually, for those times, set up a good computer system that facilitated the management of the journal. So Betsy Weisberg, I had some people that were dedicated to working on it hard. So I can manage the journal. I thought it also brought a level of prestige to our division because people who wanted their research published knew, oh, well, they saw that as, hey, that must be an important person. You know, I'm going to pay attention to him.
Okay, well, back to cancer prevention and control. Your first task when you got here was to lead a rethinking of organizational aims and processes and structure. Would you tell me about the process and how you did it?
First of all, I did it with our board of scientific counselors. In other words, I played off them. Lester Breslow was the chair, who was a wonderful old public health leader. But I actually thought myself of what we would do. Number one, I define phases of cancer control. I define cancer control as a science. I wrote a few papers about it and made five steps, phases of cancer control, and said, we're going to do one, and when we reach a point where we have enough evidence, we go to step two, to step three. And it was all moving toward applications of public benefit. They were phases of cancer control. I was fortunate enough to recruit as a deputy Joe Cullen, who had been at NCI before, but at this point was at UCLA, was very interested in tobacco control, and very outgoing, very rigorous thinking. He was trained actually as a Jesuit brother in the culinary, what's now the Culinary Institute of America. It was a monastery of some sort near Hyde Park, New York. And so he had this systematic thinking, and he applied the phases to tobacco. So as an example of how to do the phases in a public health or lifestyle sense, I looked at what was known about tobacco and what the research portfolio was of NCI. It was all on the etiology of lung cancer and nothing on the etiology of smoking, how you prevent smoking, what you do about the problem. No research on that. Redundant, ridiculously redundant research on smoking causes lung cancer, and little variations of that. So we said, okay, first we're going to do studies of preventing smoking in youth, of smoking cessation in individual groups. And that was phase one. When we felt we had enough of that, we said, we're not going to fund that anymore. You want to do that? Apply for a grant in the R01 pool. We're going to fund community studies. How do you put it together? How do you affect groups? How do you affect women who smoke, blue-collar workers who smoke, minorities who smoke? How do you get school systems to have smoking prevention programs? We did that for a while and got a body of evidence. Then we said, okay, we've got a lot there. We're going to move now. We did a community trial where we randomized 22 communities paired, similar demographics, and if we applied what we knew in those, what could we do? That was called COMMIT. And then when that got done, we said, okay, let's go for a broader thing. We're going to do what was called the ASSIST program, American Stop Smoking Intervention Trial, where we funded state health agencies together with the private sector, American Cancer Society and others, reaching a population of 95 million people, if you count the population of those states, apply everything we knew. And we did that across the country. We also had a part of this that we never told anyone about, but Joe and I would talk about it. And that was, we were funding people to do this applied research. They were in universities and in public health departments. But we knew that we were funding the activists who were raising hell and were promoting legislation and policies that we could not do as a government agency. But those people were the ones that actually moved society. They got smoke-free environments. They changed Clean Air Acts. For example, if you're in a public building and it had 5 changes of air an hour, if you were out smoking, it would have to have more because you had to have lower particulate levels. And we would do things, policies that we knew would force a change in smoking behavior across populations. And that was very useful.
But now, what time period are we talking about? How long did all these
things... We're talking about from about 1982, 83, up into the early 90s.
Okay. I just wanted to...
And there's one other thing we did. Dr. Koop, Chick Koop, or mm-hmm. C. Everett Koop, was my next-door neighbor for the 8 years. He was at the U.S. Public Health Service Surgeon General. And he was interested in tobacco control. He had come in to NIH under Reagan, actually not wanted by the people at NIH, because he'd done this picture of rubber babies in the ocean, kind of anti-abortion. But then his honesty and integrity came through in dealing with tobacco and in dealing with AIDS, and he became a hero. The Reagan group wanted to get rid of him. And he only had a staff of 5, I believe. And he did not have the capability of dealing with tobacco. He didn't have the staff or the background. So what Joe Cullen mainly and I, because I approved this, and said, Joe, don't tell me the details, but use our contracts and get all his background work done. So we'd spend $300,000 a year getting the background information. So Koop, with his wonderful public ability, would talk about tobacco control and would be a national leader in that, and an international one.
So you paid for Dr. Koop's tobacco control efforts, and Tony Fauci paid for his AIDS efforts.
Right, right. We provided the backup so mm-hmm. that he was terrific at himself, but he needed staff work, and he didn't have it within the public health service.
Which brings us back to the whole notion of whether we are, the purpose within government is public health service,
yes,
or knowledge acquisition. And it's been, a tension. I want to stop for one moment there. In your 1983 paper that you mentioned earlier, Cancer Control Research Directions and Opportunities, you laid out several premises. First was that the scientific method applies to cancer control as much as to other areas, research areas. The second was that the pursuit of excellence in science has primacy over other considerations. And the final premise was that we must build in our strengths across the spectrum from etiology to treatment. At this point in time, these premises seem obvious, but they must not have been when you arrived. And can you tell me how difficult it was?
They were not only not obvious, they were in a sense denied. And by that I mean this cancer control block of money starting at $30 million when it first came and built up was defined as you can't use it for research. And to me, it should have been defined as you can use it for what we now call translational research, for making the bridge from discovery to public benefit, whether it's patient benefit or public health benefit. And that itself is a subject of research, applied research. And it needs the same criteria of evidence and rigorous thinking and careful interpretation and scientific debate that you need in every other area of science.
Did you get much pushback in the...
I got support. You know, Vince DeVita was great. He said, you know, go to it. He just supported whatever we wanted to do. I would explain it. He'd agree. We'd go ahead. And so The pushback actually came more in the administrative area. I walked into a situation where I had a staff of about 100. I was not satisfied with the overall quality. There were a few excellent people. And so I would call them in and say, explain to me what you're doing, why, what you expect to accomplish over the next year, and I'm going to hold you accountable for it. And we went from 100 down to about 40. That was very tough, I mean, getting people to resign or move in the federal government. And then we built up to about 200 over. So, and the same with, we shifted our budgets around. Well, one example, we had a behavioral medicine program, which I support behavioral research, but I terminated that program. And the reason was, the whole focus was giving money to university psychology departments to study little psychology problems of their students. And I didn't see how that would help progress against cancer. And I wanted behavioral science, but I wanted it to include behavior of institutions, behavior of policymakers, as well as behavior of individuals, but things that really counted. So we moved the behavior into eating behavior, tobacco control, things that where we knew there was a mission-related orientation to it.
It also, it seems to me, just tell me if I've got this whole concept right, that cancer prevention, that you're defining cancer prevention as a subset of cancer control. In other words, cancer control includes more than cancer prevention includes.
Right, right. But I did that because of the way the budget came. I wanted to focus on prevention primarily. That's what my heart was in, prevention. But there were parts of this that went beyond prevention in the program that I thought were important. I'll give you a couple of examples. We started in 1983 with, actually Vince and some of the community oncologists were eager to have this, but a community clinical oncology program. It was basically a network of physicians, nurses, and their health science staffs across the country that were seeing patients. What Vince wanted and what the treatment people needed was more people going into clinical trials. They provided that. So we set up a whole network where more patients went on clinical trials. And over time, we proved that the quality of the participation was at least as good as at our major cancer centers, often better, which was, people were skeptical about. But I had a secondary motive, and that was that I knew that, I thought, I couldn't prove it absolutely, but I thought that when you had doctors all across the country taking part in trials, they saw them as their own trials. And as the results came in, they believed the results because they were their trials. And you were a leg up in the diffusion and adoption of new medical knowledge that would, was a way of continuing medical education that would help patients all over the country. And I think we pretty much showed that that was true for the doctors taking part. I had hoped it would diffuse into the hospitals and other doctors in the community. I'm not really quite sure how well that part of it worked. So there was that. And then there was another component that had to do with symptom management that we built into the community clinical oncology program that was also considered, I think, reasonably as cancer control, but not cancer prevention.
You noted in that same article that Bell Laboratories was a model program that you for channeling successful basic research into effective applications. And in an NIH that felt very strongly about basic research, which we've said, you had to recruit people, as you were talking about. You mentioned a number of people whose names I want to bring up and then ask you to comment on them and what they did for you. Jerome Yates, Joe Cullen, you already mentioned, William DeWeese, if I'm pronouncing it right, and Ed Sondick.
Okay, let me take, they're all different. Joe Cullen was a behavioral scientist, wonderful, and really organized the whole community against tobacco and did a very effective job. Jerry Yates was a clinical doctor. He'd been at Roswell Park, an excellent, very honest clinical doctor. Jerry Yates built up, he's the one that actually led in building up the community clinical oncology program, and then later with Leslie Ford, who took over doing that. So Jerry, I would say, built the CCOP program. He went on to be head of research for the American Cancer Society, and is now moving back to Buffalo. Bill DeWeiss was a problem in that Vince didn't know what to do with him in treatment. He had a difficult personality, although he was smart, a compulsive guy in a way. And he helped develop our chemo prevention program, which I'll come back to in a second. Well, let me put it this way. I see two broad directions in prevention. The one that everyone understood is a public health and lifestyle. Don't smoke, eat a healthful diet, get some exercise, that kind of thing. The other, the newer one, is a medical direction. And Michael Sporn was actually the one who first came to me. So when I came, I came in October, I think it was still in 1981, that Michael Sporn came in, who had created a lab of chemo prevention around 1975 or 76, and said, look at my data, what are you going to do about it? I mean, people think of the field of epidemiology as a science for public health, but none of the epidemiologists, except maybe Bill Blatt, none of them came to me and said, look at our data, what are you going to do? All they wanted to do was publish papers, at which we get them tenure and promotions, and it was somebody else's problem. They wouldn't take the lead. But Michael Sporn said, look at, you know, there's something useful in this. And what we did was build a medical approach. The rough comparison is to heart disease that's easy to use. Find the risk, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, bring it down with drugs or with bioactive food. So Mike Sporn brought that. Ed Sondek, we were lucky in that I think Ed had been at the Heart Institute first. Ed was an expert in systems analysis, statistics, but mainly systems. He had a very integrative mind of how things fit together, how you can move them forward, how one thing relates to another. Wonderful personality. I felt he was, for a short time after that, he was actually acting director of NCI after Sam Brown. I thought he was the best one we had. But of course, he was just acting, and now he's the head of the National Center for Health Statistics. But he came first running this program with community oncology, but then he was my deputy director. Uh-huh. And it was Ed and I who mainly led in this goals for the year 2000 that we did in 1985. And what we did, we had four committees related to our board of scientific counselors. One on prevention, one on early detection, one on treatment, and one on surveillance. And we had these groups of experts look at the most that could be accomplished if we applied everything we knew today, today being 1985. And they thought it through very carefully. We wrote out these projections. For example, in tobacco, if we could bring rates down by 1990, here's the outcome. If we couldn't do it till 2000, here's the outcome. Projections, and Ed Sondek did a lot of the projecting and figuring out very carefully. Only put a small percent on early detection. We could reduce deaths by 3%, we felt. And we ended up with a bottom line that we would be able to reduce cancer deaths by 25 to 50% depending on how fast things were applied. And we wrote a whole volume on this, a monograph for the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. What happened, I think to this day, all of it was generally accurate with one exception in the treatment area. Vince DeVita, I think mainly him and some others, were very sold on a study that I think came from Montreal about prostate cancer treatment, that knocking out all the androgens would knock down the death rate tremendously, and it was wishful thinking. So the projection of treatment was more than what could actually be accomplished, and we ended up saying, well, the rate of decline of improved therapy was maybe 1% a year. If we went to 1.5%, here's what we could get by discovery. So we made all these estimates and we put out the goals. Then we ran into a problem of applying it. We got ridiculed for saying, well, you did these goals and you haven't done anything. You know, it's a farce, so basically. Well, the problem there was something that you actually mentioned. What does NIH see as its mission? My view was we never tried. We laid out the goal, but they required an aggressive effort to achieve the goal, to implement. Nobody wanted to implement. Nobody wanted to put money into that at NIH. And then if you didn't achieve it, well, what's the big surprise? But that's what happened. We had goals that I think still are worth looking back at, but we never made the effort at following through, at implementing. We tried to, but it would cost a lot and it didn't come. You know, I came from a public health background. I'd been in New York State for 12 years before in the health department, right, primarily, and I knew that you could implement things like that, but our effort was pretty anemic at doing that.
I want to go through some of the programs that were created. I have, in 82, you've already talked a little bit about the smoking and tobacco control program. And this comes back to the implementation and to a question I asked you the last time. You have the prevention goal of stopping people from starting to smoke.
Right.
But then you have smoking cessation by adults. And here you start to overlap with the addiction problem and the National Institute on Drug Abuse and other things like that. And I always wondered why it took so long for some of the chemical, like the patches and the gums and things, to get out there to people. And I wondered if your division had any kind of involvement in doing that kind of...
To some extent, I always felt preventing the onset in children or delaying it, if you got them beyond high school up to age 20 or so, meant most of them wouldn't start at all. So that was a goal, to prevent it in schools. But that would take decades because they wouldn't reach the cancer risk age group for a long, long time. So we thought you needed cessation to really have an impact early enough that we would see it. And yet we knew that it took many years after you stop for the risk to really come down. It would sort of level off at the level where you stopped. It wouldn't get worse, but it took 15 years or so, and you know, it was modest. In fact, at this point, there are probably slightly more lung cancers occurring among people who are former smokers than smokers, because they're older and it takes this long time. So we thought we had to address that. We did not at first do a lot on the drugs themselves. There was effort at behavioral approaches, what works, what kind of message. Things, for example, like for a doctor, it's important to ask the patient if they want to quit. 90% want to quit. Give them a strong message that they should quit. Set a follow-up appointment for them, come in and tell you what they done. Have your nurse or someone call them up a few times and say, how's it going? So there were things where you might get from a 15% to a 20 or 25%, you know, when patients would quit for a year. But it was far from perfect. It was...
Right, but who was... Were you all addressing the issue of why it wasn't doing any better? In other words,
not,
the addiction issue is what I'm...
Not a lot. Neither did a little. That's more recent. I mean, the things like... there's a drug called varenicline or Shantix of Pfizer that inhibits nicotine from reaching the receptors in the brain. And there are several vaccines that are in clinical trials now that do a similar thing. We know that nicotine is a driver of a lot of smoking, but at that point in the 80s, there was a little work from Ernst Winder's group, but it was more on how does the nicotine get into you, you know, what type of filters and things like that. You know, a little bit about the chemistry, but it didn't really address how do you interfere with the chemistry in a way that people will want to stop.
I don't want to spend too much time on this, but there was also the argument that was going on whether or not it was an addiction, and I don't remember just when that
right.
changed.
Whether you call it habituation or addiction, we never got into that.
All right, let's move from smoking to chemo prevention. Okay. You mentioned this earlier, too.
There's also a whole diet story in between.
Oh, well, I have diet.
You can do it later.
I'm coming. I just guess I got
okay,
it out
that's
of order.
Okay.
But anyway,
I
know what it is. It's 1982. The chemo prevention branch was created, and 83 is when the diet and cancer branch. So I put it in chronological order.
That's
all.
Fine. Oh, that's fine.
You said that you had been contacted by Michael Sporn talking about this. Now, I think the public would love to think that they could take a pill that would prevent cancer. That's what they would think. Would you define chemo prevention broadly and explain how it worked and what you all did?
I see chemo prevention as medical approaches to lowering your risk for cancer. That is, ways of lessening your chances from getting it. It's obviously not total prevention, but it's the same as what heart disease people say when they say prevention improves your chances, lessens your risk. So what first came up, Michael Sporn working with retinoids and other, and Lee Wattenberg at the University of Minnesota working with usually cruciferous vegetables, Brussels sprout type things, and those chemicals, had evidence in animal models and mice that you could prevent some cancers, quite a few. And so they were saying, look at it clinically. What we took on a couple different directions then in deciding to do this. One was to build a preclinical through early phase human clinical research at chemo prevention to look at all the array of potential chemicals that might have benefits and figure out how to move them forward. Some were drugs and some were food compounds, vitamins, minerals, other bioactive food compounds. So we started a process that would lead us into the trials. We would set aside monies and request for applications to get a community of scientists working on those trials, mainly aiming toward early studies. That was, at the same time, we started two very large trials. One was in China, in Linshan, China. And actually, the idea came from our epidemiologists, particularly Bill Blott and Phil Taylor worked on it. Where they had actually thought about it before I came on the scene. But we jumped in and worked on this large vitamin mineral study of what we thought initially was cancer of the esophagus. It turned in a place that had the highest rate in the world. It turned out to be both the esophagus and the upper part of the stomach, the cardio of the stomach. And we ended up showing that a combination of selenium, vitamin E, and beta-carotene cut the stomach cancer rate by about a fifth. But what I wanted to do was get a big trial rolling before other results came in. So even if the first results were negative, people wouldn't say, oh, there's nothing to that field. The field would be ongoing. At the same time, we thought that beta-carotene, which was being promoted by the vitamin pill industry, could be preventive against lung cancer, and that vitamin E had some possibilities of being preventive, that is reducing the risk of lung cancer. So we got together with some Finnish scientists, excellent scientists, and one of them, Olli Heinonen had been a classmate of mine at Harvard School of Public Health, and was a leader in public health in Finland, and with other people with us. We designed a trial in 29,000 heavy smokers that could be done very efficiently through some what were all TB clinics around Finland. And we did an intervention trial that we thought might prevent lung cancer in smokers. There was a very interesting outcome, which was not what we expected.
Yeah. Right.
But
right.
That came years later. And that was that beta-carotene made things worse. In the smokers.
I remember when that came out.
And that the vitamin E actually, as a not a prior hypothesis, seemed to reduce prostate cancer by a third. So there are two interesting outcomes. One thing about the beta carotene, because there's misinterpretation of it today, at that point in time, a lot of epidemiologists were implying that beta carotene prevented cancer. the vitamin pill industry had picked that up and taught people, the public, the word beta-carotene, like here's this magical food constituent, and they were selling it. And there was no clinical evidence. So I think the epidemiologists ended up misleading us because they'd see a marker of maybe vegetable intake. In the trial, if I kind of round off the numbers a little, there were 29,000 people in the trial divided into half. So 14,500, about 14,500 got beta-carotene, and about 14,500 got placebo for beta-carotene. Of the group on beta-carotene, roughly 6 men, they were all men, per 1,000 per year developed lung cancer. On those on placebo, about 5 per 1,000 per year developed lung cancer, a difference of 1 per 1,000 per year. Actually, that's 20%. It was a 16% higher rate. In my view, the most astute physician or the best epidemiologist could never pick up that tiny difference.
Yeah.
It took a very well-designed, double-blind, randomized clinical trial, which is what we were doing. And yet, it has great public health importance. And it was the first thing that said, hold on now, taking large doses of one vitamin or another doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be better off. You know, you need evidence before you make that kind of decision.
And I was trying to remember when the dietary supplements program got started. That was later, I believe, because that was done with and designed so there would be no FDA regulation. And you have that, as you described, the impetus from the commercial side
right.
to convince
right.
you that it's a good thing.
Right, and those companies, because the way the Food and Drug Administration legislation is written, the FDA does not have authority to assist on efficacy in the marketing of foods or supplements, vitamins and minerals. They just don't have the authority. And there were people in Congress who were in states that had those industries that insisted on that kind of legislation.
And there, this sort of brings us back to some other things we've talked about, the need to communicate to the public why you run a clinical trial
yes.
and why this is important, because there is a great deal of public trust that if
right.
they put it out there on the TV, it's bound to be true. And
it's a distortion. The same thing's happening with antioxidants.
Yes.
The public has been taught the word antioxidants as a sticker. To me, there is probably no such thing. They're all redox systems. They can be antioxidant in one microenvironment, let's say, and pro-oxidant, where the beta-carotene may be in the aerated lung where you have the drive of tobacco carcinogens, pro-oxidant, same chemical. So there, you know, you have to really understand the chemistry. But I'm not an expert in chemistry, but you don't want to just so oversimplify and then hype something where there's no evidence. And we've got these examples of heart disease and cancer. And there's probably some harm from unbalanced large doses.
Indeed. In your 1996 article in Scientific American about chemo
yeah.
prevention, it suggested to me that the surface has really just been scratched in this area.
Right.
That can you tell me where it stands now and what problems
well,
still
need
to be overcome?
Well, I think it's still the surface has just been scratched. So, and I say that because we have a lot of leads. Many, many. It's almost the opposite problem of treatment, where we have in treatment getting some drugs that really work. You know, there are only a few drugs coming out of this enormous effort. What we have in prevention, a lot of things that look like they potentially could have benefits, we don't have the capability of following through and testing them all in clinical research, or even coning down. We have very few clinical trials in cancer prevention. They're all expensive, they're many years, some are $100 million trials. To me, that's not expensive, because if you look at the aggregate investment, it's small compared to other fields. But if you look at each individual one, what we have is people saying, oh my gosh, look how many labs you're doing. And, you know, they almost want to prove them before you do the trial, and that's impossible. So I think our investment is small. The potential of the field is really important. We're looking at how best to get buy-in by industry, how to get buy-in at NCI and NIH. That's varied according to who the directors were. The current director does not like it, and so he wants all of it to be discovery, and we can't get new large clinical trials in place. So it's always been uphill, but it's been a lot easier with Vince DeVita, a lot easier actually with Sam Broder, who understood this. There was one other problem, but and from Klausner on, it's been a bit of a problem.
Well, let's move on and talk a bit about the diet in cancer.
Yes.
Branch, which was established in 1983. I'm going to tell you what I know and then let you take it and expand on it. I'd like to know who headed this, and that you start out knowing that diet and eating behaviors are thought to be related to approximately one-third of all cancers. That's very significant. The budget grew rapidly, and I'd like to know what your thinking was here and how it played out.
Okay, the first key thing, although many of us thought about this before, but in 1981, two eminent British epidemiologists, Richard Dahl and Richard Pitot, under a contract from NCI, looked at avoidable causes of cancer and published this volume. And that's where the estimate of roughly a third, within broad boundaries of uncertainty, but roughly a third of all cancer has dietary determinants, food determinants. The last time I saw Dahl, which was 10 or 12 years ago before he died, he put the bounds at 40 to 60%. But that came largely looking at international differences, at effects of migrating populations, where when people move from one country to another, they, or especially their children, took on the risk of the place to which they moved. And the most logical explanation was definitely change in lifestyle, and diet was the biggest factor. So we had this rough estimate. We have some general epidemiologic data, not a lot of basic nutritional science, some debates in the nutrition community over dietary fat and things. And the first thing we wanted to do was just get some research going that was sound. There was a Dr. Ritva Buttram, B-U-T-R-U-M, who came, and Carolyn Clifford. Mostly Ritva was very dynamic in coming forward with requests for applications and set-asides, where we put money aside just to get people doing research on diet and cancer. And that built up the budget. Then we came into some public issues. They sort of overlapped. The one was fiber and the other was fat. I'll take one at a time. So in February 1984, I went to the Food and Drug Administration. Sanford Miller, Sandy Miller, was head of the food side of the FDA, and Frank Yang was head of the FDA. And I went there because I thought they should change their standards of identity. The standards of identity was what defined a food, and I didn't think they were on the side of good health. So, for example, if you had a margarine, you had to use words like artificial. For a food that might be more healthful, you had to use words that had a negative connotation because of some of the industry lobbying, say for butter or dairy or something like that. And so I went to them and said, why don't you change it so your standards are on the side of good health? And Sandy Miller said, well, we appreciate your thinking. We've been doing this way for 75 years. We're not going to change. Do it your own way. Good luck. And so later that year, in between, there was a lot of discussion of fiber. A fellow named Dennis Burkett of Burkett's Lymphoma had published things about the size of the stool of people in Africa and the fact that they had very little colon diseases, cancer, everything else, appendicitis, GI problems, and attributed that to more dietary fiber in their diet.
I remember that.
And he came through, he convinced Vince DeVita, who went on the McNeil Air Show, and said, I eat a bran muffin every day. And I, up to that point, I'd been saying vegetables, fruits, and whole grains. But then I looked at it and said, okay, we can say fiber. We did a little review and pulled the data together. And so then Margaret Heckler, we started a cancer prevention awareness campaign, that is, I did with our Office of Communication, Paul Van Nevel, later that year in 1984. And Margaret Heckler, who was HHS secretary under Ronald Reagan, wanted to kick it off. So she was a pleasant lady. She came to the Mazur Auditorium and made this announcement for us and said, we invite industry in to take part. So I think it was next day, within a couple of days, Kellogg, someone from Kellogg calls, we'd like to hear what you're saying. So I said, sure. So they show up with some scientists, good scientists, a nutrition scientist, I think, from Wisconsin, and plus their own people. And I spent an afternoon with them going through our evidence and what our message was. Eat a variety of foods with high in fiber, things like that. They said, oh, we're going to put it on our cereal box. So I said, okay, but you have to put the whole message. You can't just say eat more fiber. They agreed to that. And literally, they did that. But I think they probably had focus groups, because the impression you got was that fiber is all bran.
Yeah.
that's the impression that the public got. And they marketed this, and they blocked out it. They marketed it all. They blocked out all the TV stations at once. And over the next 3 years, the cereal fiber sales went up dramatically, although they tapered off a few years later. The FDA was furious at me because they did, up till that point, no health claims were allowed on foods. And the Reagan administration used this as a lever to reduce the regulation that more or less allowed implied health claims on foods, and that put the FDA on the spot. And they blamed me.
I see.
but fiber consumption went up. A little later along those lines, this was about 1987, I wanted state health agencies to use their database to promote public health and cancer prevention. So we set money aside for that. And a group in California came in with what they were calling five-a-day program. It basically was eat 5 to 9 vegetables. We looked at that, decided we loved the public, the positive message, and we revamped it with them. They held the license, and with others, and we started this five-a-day program with a partnership with industry and the private sector. The industry, this would be mainly the produce manufacturers and the bigger supermarket chains. So they came, and then they said, oh, you're too slow, government. We set up our own little corporation, Five a Day for the Better Health Foundation. They collected $400,000 in a day or something like that. And then this was a going organization. We set it up so we would have to approve the message. So they would not be allowed to market something that had a downside with the Five a Day label. They couldn't, say, sell French fries. Right. They could sell a baked potato. Or say broccoli and cheese, all that's probably good, but it had high fat, so it's not allowed. So industry did it, and within less than a year, there were billions of gross impressions. A gross impression is like one person seeing a stamp on a plastic bag in the market a day, and 80% of the supermarkets in the country were using this message. It was just all over the place. I think it improved understanding a bit from what evaluation did, although it's still hard to get kids to eat the vegetables. It did some.
Just one related question. Do you have any input when it's the Agriculture Department, I believe, that does the food pyramid?
Yes. Not the recent one. Let me go mostly through fat. And like the current pyramid's a problem. There's no food shown on the current display. I mean, it's absurd. And individual variability may be a fact, but you look at that and you don't know what you're supposed to eat.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, we've had a mixed relation with the USDA, some of it outstanding, with Beltsville scientists who interest in health. They have some good labs, and we collaborate. We still have people that works with them. And then there's a political overlay at the leadership of USDA that varies with the administration, so it's a little tricky. But in general, it's been okay. Dietary fat was a different story. I came in 1981. I had been on a committee of the Institute of Medicine Food and Nutrition Board. I started when I was in New York State. And I was invited because I had helped them with a committee on nitrites, and I'd written a part. So they asked me to be on the Food and Nutrition Board, which is a big deal to food people, but I didn't even know what it was when I went on. Well, I got there, and there was this bickering between leading nutrition scientists over the fat message, accusing each other. It was terrible because they were accusing the young people. The older group saying, you don't have the evidence on fat, and the newer group saying, fat increases your cancer risk. I looked at it and thought, fat increases your risk. And then they started accusing me of being a plant from NCI, even though I'd been on it before I was added to it. But a lot of the roots of the problem were the way fat was measured. The standard way in epidemiology was a food frequency questionnaire, which is basically the percent of your diet that is fat. Mm-hmm. So it's a way of adjusting for energy. Mm-hmm. And it's not grams of fat, which is the total amount of fat, but just the percent. So even though we were promoting these guidelines, cut down fat, meaning cut percent of calories from fat, we would joke on the side that you could fit the guidelines by drinking more Coke. That is, if you took in, as a denominator, you took in more calories, but they were non-fat calories, sugar, your percent calories from fat would go down. So in that sense, it was absurd. We sort of focused on grams. And what never occurred to us when we were saying that was that industry would come in over the next 5 to 10 years with many, many foods that they'd market as low fat. They were useless calorie junk foods. And people got fat. They were eating all this stuff. Portion size was going up. Volume was sold as a value, whether it was fast food or major restaurants. Plate sizes were getting bigger and bigger. Kids could go into a movie house and have a 32-inch Coke, sugar water and caffeine, or 40 ounce. And so we have this growing problem of obesity, plus sedentary society, plus calories and calories. But I think a lot of it was we didn't look at the fat issue exactly right. Then all through the 80s, starting maybe 83 or 84, meaning Maureen Henderson, who was an epidemiologist at that point out in Seattle, University of Washington, Ross Prentice, who's probably one of the best statisticians in the world, was head of the group at University of Washington, and I wanted to do a woman's health trial, which was basically a study of if you, in a clinical trial, a randomized trial, if you cut calories from fat, mm-hmm. would you lower breast cancer risk? And we would bring this to the National Cancer Advisory Board time after time after time. And they would come in loaded to shoot us down. Before I could get out the second sentence, they'd be attacking it because they were counting up how many labs you would fund for the $100 million we wanted to do this trial. So that went on until Bernadine Healy came in. I don't know if that's a later period. But so when Sam Broder was health commissioner, Bernadine Healy came in as head of NIH. Her background was cardiologist, and she knew that the idea of taking estrogens for almost every woman after menopause had never been proven in a clinical trial. It was promoted from about 1960 or 61, sometime back there, as you're not normal, especially California women, if you don't take estrogens, you're not normal, take estrogens. And it never been proven. And she wanted to do this clinical trial. So she sat at a meeting of the institute directors, ICD's Institute Center directors, that she wanted a women's health initiative. What I had said was women's health trial. She wanted a women's health initiative. Sam Broder came back. This was like a Wednesday. He came back to the executive and said, Peter, Bernadine Healy wants to do a women's health initiative. Here's your chance. Meaning, in my interpretation, here's your chance to get NIH to pay for it, not NCI, and get your program in. So I got together with Ed Sondek, this wonderful person who knew how to put together trials and things. And we asked Bill Harlan, who was at the Heart Institute running their clinical trials program, so we knew we had to be more than just NCI. And our aim was to get a proposal in Bernadine Healy's lab by that Friday. It was already Thursday. So we knew that Friday night she'd fly back to Cleveland and that she'd have it, she could read it on the airplane. So in 24 hours, we wrote a proposal to do a women's health initiative that had the fat part, had the calcium and bone prevention, and had the estrogen progestin part. And thinking that it would be a point of discussion, you know. So we had this proposal, and we did a back-of-the-envelope quick calculation, $500 million, because we knew what trials cost. So next Monday, she walks into Congress and announces NIH is doing a women's health initiative. It will cost $500 million. It was a spectacular example of leadership in medicine. She was wonderful. And I mean, some people at NIH hated it and didn't care for her, but I was really proud of her. And nobody could say no after that. It was announced to Congress we were doing it. And then there was about a year of committees and discussions, mostly led by the Heart Institute, Jack Rousseau and others at the Heart Institute, and because she wanted it, Heart, that was fine. You have to go. So that kicked off the Women's Health Initiative. Bernadine Healy was the leader.
And he kept all the three parts to it.
It ended up after a year of things very much like what we originally wrote, but it was buy-in and input by all these different people all across the country. And I think a lot of the intellectual input and clinical trial expertness came from the heart disease people, the NHLBI, Jacques Rousseau particularly. And they did it. I kind of got help getting going. I backed off because some of our staff, especially some of the women scientists, took part. And interesting outcome. Some of it a surprise. The estrogen plus progestin probably did harm and ended this overuse and probably stopped enough use of breast cancer in the past few years. Has come down a bit, in part because of women stopping taking estrogen. The dietary fat in breast cancer, to me, was inconclusive. They said it was negative, but when you look at the data, there's no change for about 4 years. And then those on low fat start to do slightly better, and it spreads toward the time that they stop the trial. So when you look at the trend line, you think that's a study that needs a longer follow-up, that it might be that you had some benefit early in carcinogenesis, and you just have to wait longer before you can say effect or no effect. And it was a hint toward a benefit, but not statistically significant, so they had to conclude, if you're going to cut it off then, that you didn't see a benefit, but my view was you want to follow them longer.
How do these studies compare with the Framingham Heart Study in terms of, do we need that kind of long-term?
We need long-term and even longer, and I think follow-up for life. I can give you an example from other studies, but even that one, I mean, it's much more tricky with diet, but take the hormone part. Mm-hmm. Okay. There are all these piggyback studies, some. I'm not on top of all the one with the Women's Health Initiative. But say there's an effect of cognitive function of estrogen use, and the time to event is different from the time to event for heart attacks. So say it's 20 years later, you either have a benefit or harm on your brain. You won't know that if you don't do a long-term follow-up. And there's no biomarker study or quick way of shortening that timeline. And once you made this enormous investment, the investment for continued follow-up after the intervention stopped is actually fairly small and important. There are always people that want to say, well, why do you have to go any further? Let's stop it. But in my view, you want the long-term follow-up, and you get a lot out of it, and sometimes in these little extra studies that were not part of the main plan, but look at the person as a whole and other disease categories and not just the key one you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. It's It's in some respects, it's the very difficult sales proposition of the big investment now will pay off over time when people want to know what they've got for this year and next year.
Right, the short term. But we can get both. And in prevention, one thing I worry a bit about is adverse events. You know, in cancer therapy, especially late stage, you don't want a lot of bad side effects, but you're willing to take the risk to a pretty good extent. In prevention, you don't want that risk, or you want to absolutely minimize adverse events because the proportion of people really benefit is small. Now, one thing where the two fields of prevention and treatment are coming close together is what we call adjuvant therapy, treatment of early stage disease. So, for example, with localized breast cancer, when a lot of them now have a lumpectomy and radiation, or they may have some tamoxifen, say, a hormone estrogen receptor modulator. Well, you have to treat thousands to have a number have a benefit, and as the survival is very good in the first place, and you've already shown that, say, tamoxifen does a good job, now to show a benefit on that residual 10% or so, you need a huge population in a long-term study. So, and you don't want much toxicity. So it's not that different than some of the prevention trials.
Okay. In 1983, you created the Community Clinical Oncology Program, or CCOP.
Right.
In 1996, you had 51 programs in 30 states funded by the CCOP, and it's now to at least 214 hospital. Tell me about how this is helping the expansion of prevention as well as therapy.
Okay. Now, as we mentioned, part of it was to get patients on trials, and we're now contributing to about a third of all patients on cancer treatment trials that are run by the federal government. So it's a huge proportion, but my division does not drive what the drugs are that are being tested. That's our division of cancer treatment, but we bring people on the trials. The big thing in prevention was several of the large cancer prevention trials were run through the CCOP, the Community Clinical Oncology Program. And I can run through, say, the breast cancer ones and the prostate cancer ones, and there's some colorectal. So on breast cancer, if you go back, there's a group called NSABP, National Surgical Adjuvant Breast and Bowel Project. There are two B's in the real name, but there's one in the initials. And it was led by Bernard Fisher, an outstanding surgeon at the University of Pittsburgh, who set up this network, a national network across the country, that I believe was probably the biggest or one of the biggest contributors to progress against breast cancer in the whole century. You know, they almost every major study in treatment and prevention, they led. There may have been others who did similar studies, but they were huge leaders. So one study they did was tamoxifen for adjuvant therapy of breast cancer. That is, a woman would have breast cancer, she'd be treated with tamoxifen to lower the chance of recurrence. And what was observed, besides the fact that that worked, was there were about half as many new cancers in the opposite breast. So that's some of the basic science behind it made us think that we should do a prevention trial. So we sponsored a breast cancer prevention trial in over 13,000 women. And it was run through this network, a cooperative agreement with the NSABP. And basically women were randomized, healthy women. They did not have cancer. They had the risk of a 60-year-old, although they could have been younger. There's something called a Gale model of measuring risk. And the result was it showed a 49% reduction in the occurrence rate of breast cancer. So we prevented about half of breast cancer using this drug, the estrogen receptor modulator called tamoxifen. There were a few side effects, a little more endometrial cancer, though none fatal, and with every estrogenic compound, more blood clot problems, a few of which were serious. But unbalanced, most women were better off. but there were a few that got the... So we proved definitively for the first time that a medical approach can prevent some breast cancer.
How is this going to interface with the rise of individualized genetics? I mean, will this be able to, you can say this woman will benefit from tamoxifen and this one may not?
It's hard to answer because there are not enough in this large population, there are not enough with BRCA1 or BRCA2 genes or other genes that we aren't so sure about to say whether that subgroup benefits or not. They're a little hint that they do to some extent, but we don't have the answer from this study. There are other studies of that, but that's tricky. I think of it, not everyone says personalized medicine. I think of it as stratified medicine. That is, you can stratify groups into risk. For example, there's HER2, where about 20% of breast cancer patients have this amplified gene that has a bad outcome. And you can aim for treating those particularly. So there may be groups that you can address. You're not going to treat each individual as a special case, but if you're in this group, you might get a different therapy or prevention than another. We may be able to pull some things about that out from the biorepositories, the bloods that were collected and the white cells.
Yes.
So there are ways of getting at that that's being worked on, but we don't really have a good answer to that. The follow-through of breast cancer is interesting. So the next thing that happened was, while this was going on, starting a little bit later, there was a study of a drug called raloxifene, or Avista. Raloxifene was being used for osteoporosis, to prevent progression of osteoporosis. And there's a study called MORE, Multiple Outcomes of Raloxifene Efficacy, that showed that women on raloxifene, they not only had improvement in fewer fractures, they had less breast cancer, like 60 or 65% less, something around there. And so women with osteoporosis aren't particularly at high risk for breast cancer. If anything, their estrogens are a little lower. But we have these two drugs now that seem to have benefits. And we decided we needed a head-to-head comparison, which one works better for whom. So we started a trial, again with NSABP in the lead, called the STAR trial, Study of Tamoxifen and Raloxifene, over 19,000 women. And the outcome was they were equivalent when you looked at the adverse event and the overall picture. In general, the raloxifene looked a little better. And the company got it through the Food and Drug Administration as approved use. This past Mother's Day, they started an advertising campaign. If you looked on the women with a towel around them saying, if you want to prevent breast cancer and osteoporosis, raise your hand. I don't understand the ad, but that's what they're...
We've seen the ad trying to figure out what it was about because we've watched
it. It's about breast cancer prevention. They're marketing it for breast cancer prevention in women at risk for osteoporosis, but it does both. So that was fine. The next one, I ran into a problem of with the current and CI director, if it's not jumping ahead too much. Okay, so we had these two drugs that prevent some breast cancer. What they actually prevent are the hormonally driven breast cancers, which is about 70% of them, called ER-positive or estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer. They don't prevent the 30% that are ER-negative. So we are developing a group of studies to see if we can address the ER-negative. But there's another set of compounds called aromatase inhibitors that prevent you from making estrogen. And we thought might be more effective in preventing the ER positive. And potentially, hopefully, could teach us how to prevent as much as 70% of postmenopausal breast cancer. And so the NSABP group and I wanted to do a trial of a head-to-head comparison of raloxifene, the best outcome for the STAR trial, versus aromatase inhibitor, because they had different mix of benefits and also possible adverse events, and you need a balanced picture before deciding. The NSABP put in their application, they got the best review, the best score they ever got in their whole history. A lot of people were for it. the current NCI director blocked it without giving a logical reason. He wants to do basic research. He didn't like the study, never explained why. He had said, even though I'm not sure, I think he had already made up his mind, but he had said he wanted to hear a discussion at the National Cancer Advisory Board about this. He set up a committee to look at it, which was stacked toward what he wanted as an outcome. There was a discussion at the National Cancer Advisory Board. I spoke out clearly, defended the trial, made him look a bit like a fool, as well as the committee chair. And he's retaliated ever since, and hopefully he'll be out when Obama appoints his next NCI director. But, I mean, basically, we have something that called the CORE, the Commission Officer Effectiveness Report. It's your personnel report. So he had Al Raps and his deputy, who is well-liked, but at this point he's a pathetic old man who just wants to hang on to his job. You can put that in the record. That's what he is. And so he wrote me up as sort of mediocre compared to, you know. And he told me on the phone that it was because Dr. Niederhuber, the NCI director, was still mad at me for speaking out and giving my scientific opinion, basically, that we want to prevent up to 70% of breast cancer, and he didn't want to do it because he wanted to put the money in his own little pet things. So that's still going on.
Which explains strongly that science is not something that all scientists agree on,
right.
Social factors.
Right. But you have a problem when you have a director who's believes very much in centralized, top-down, I'm the expert on everything.
Yes.
And that's who we have right now.
Let me stop. In December 83, when you were setting up the new Division of Cancer Prevention and Control, you wanted to base its activities on scientific data. And the first thing that I see that you did was to develop something called the Prevention Trials Decision Network, the PTDN, as a means to formalize the prioritization evaluation process. There was also the Endpoints and Biomarkers Committee. And would you talk about those two and what was going on here?
Right. We basically wanted to build criteria of evidence and logic that would fit cancer prevention. So we defined some of these things. We started to work with them. Some of it was very practical and work, some sort of faded. So the Prevention Trials Decision Network, we did it for a while, but there weren't enough different trials to think about. So we ended up kind of going case by case and then gathering people that were expert in the various things and arguing each trial as we went along. There was one committee set up. I'm not sure what the name of it was, but it might be the Early Detection. I think it was the Early Detection
Research Network.
Yeah. Well, that was the formal name that came out of it a little later. But it was a committee that was chaired by Barry Kramer. And I'm not sure if I pronounce his name right. I'll come back to it. Okay. So it was Bernard Levine, but it's spelled Levin, L-E-V-I-N, but he pronounces it Levine, who was head of prevention at MD Anderson Cancer Center. So they co-chaired a committee of our board of scientific counselors that came up with a plan for Early Detection Research Network. And the basic issue was we were getting to where a lot of people were working on biomarkers without a really rigorous definition of what a biomarker was. Is it something where there's an association with the cancer? Is it something on the etiologic pathway? Is it something that tells you a prognosis about outcome of therapy? Is it something that tells you risk and exposure, documents exposure? So it was sort of a fuzzy, broad area, but everyone was saying biomarker research, and they all had their own. There were a myriad of markers. And the problem was the number that were validated, meaning clinically useful and proven, would be zero. The closest would be what pathologists were telling you was precancerous lesions, adenomatous polyps, leukoplakia of the mouth, it's called intraepithelial neoplasia, late stage pap tests before they turn into cancer. But they weren't these clinical molecular markers. Epstein said everyone was imagining would be great genetic markers. So this group recommended we set up an early detection research network that would aim at doing some developmental work on biomarkers, although a lot of that was going on, so probably it was just capturing what was going on, but then putting it into a set of steps that would move toward validation. So I'll give you one example. David Shadransky, who's a leader of this, an excellent scientist at Johns Hopkins, had done a study of mitochondrial DNA mutations that he felt would help predict risk of head and neck cancer and of bladder cancer. And he's a great scientist, but the way he did the work was a very rigorous sequencing of DNA that most labs cannot do. So we then went to NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and said, okay, make this into some sort of chip that a good pathology lab can do, so we can see if others can replicate this test and see if it holds up in the larger clinical study. So we had to take it from beautiful discovery work by, yes, first-class scientists to, is it something that we can find out if it can be replicated and used by others, and then bring it into clinical testing. So that's still going on. But there are other examples of that with a number of different things, telomerase, whole list of things. And we're working toward getting things validated. What's turning out is that's a costly long-term process. It's not easy. And there's all this wishful thinking about biomarkers. But to really work them out so they're useful and prove it is not so easy and takes time. But that program does that, and that's what it was set up to do, and it's highly respected, a national program at this point.
Another one of the overarching programs that I see in this period is the SEER program, Surveillance, Epidemiology, and End Results. Was this, you want to talk a little more about that?
Well, that's the cancer registry system of the United States. It was here before I got here. It was started, they actually started with, I think it was a 10-city or 10-defined population study. So when I was here, Brenda Edwards, who's a wonderful scientist, was managing this, very good manager. It was a going program. I didn't have to do much except support what they already were doing and wanted to do.
But you supported the expansion.
I supported the expansion. We wanted to make sure that we covered enough of the major demographic populations, so there'd be enough Hispanics, enough different groups. Mm-hmm. And also we wanted to do special studies that were more than just a cancer registry, but would give us specific information about outcomes, health outcomes. And there's a field of research called outcomes research. Mm-hmm. Part of it was done with the registries, part was done with groups like Kaiser, these group effects where you could have a population under surveillance and could relate it to outcomes within their own computer systems. And it's a very well-run study. That expanded more with the CDC collaboration, where a lot of states, most of them I think now almost all, have some sort of cancer registry system. I kind of had a rule of thumb that you want to spend at least as much on use of the data as you do on collecting it and publishing annual reports. SEER did that in the sense that all of NCI was using it, especially the epidemiologists. But in many places, the means have become the ends. They have a registry, and that's all they have.
That's all they have.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. That's... Well, along with that kind of thing, you created a special population studies branch and a minority-based program, too. Was this a broader thing at NIH, or was this something just within...
We had initially, I'm not sure, maybe 83 or so, I had Lou Sullivan on my board of scientific advisors, who was president of Morehouse in Atlanta. And a wonderful program person, Claudia Baquet, B-I-Q-U-E-T, who is running our minority program. They, as part of our board, and just we talk with them, felt we needed an African American leader, what's called National Black Leadership Initiative on Cancer. And they developed it. I sort of watched and supported them. They were the leaders, Lou Sullivan and Claudia Baquet. And they essentially got the historically black medical schools and some other groups into science, mostly applications of science and studies of that, and built a strong network that would work on that. After that, was it Reagan? Yeah. Lou Sullivan was then named as HHS secretary. He would still call back every week when he was HHS secretary to talk to Claudia. And so we had this connection. And they were wonderful. They kept moving this program. It worked well. Claudia's now at University of Maryland. So we had a way of addressing disparities. And my feeling was we wanted to get minority scientists who would be leaders in these fields and not just one-shot deals that would end when the money ran out, but something that would be more permanent. And they were very savvy about it. Then we used that as a model and built a Hispanic Leadership Initiative on Cancer and an Appalachian Initiative. And they were starts at addressing disparity issues.
And speaking to disparity issues, there was a very interesting statement that I noted, and that was that, quote, research is underway that will help standardize the way in which healthcare providers assess health quality of life for minority populations, unquote. Why is assessing for minority populations different from assessing the health quality of life for the majority population?
I don't think it's different in what you want to accomplish. I think there are cultural differences in perception and understanding, and whether going to a hospital is a benefit or a place to die, and access, and there's certain prejudices. I think they're lessening now by a lot, but about how people are perceived, what kind of therapy they'll get according to who they are. And so there were, and it's been changing over time, but there were issues over cultural sensitivity and understanding and access.
Are the different programs, for example, for trying to reach a minority teenage population with stop smoking messages from another?
I don't always think of it so much now as minority as the lower income, poorly educated. I mean, we have now a large middle class minority, and they're the same as the
I understand white. That. And that's
so if you're talking about the
economic stratification.
Yeah, and Harold Freeman was a person who spoke a lot about that. He chaired the President's Cancer Panel and worked with us. And so I think you have to look at who the group is that you really want to help impact. And if you stratify by education level, it's the poor minority, plus poor white, have some
But what about the differences, perhaps, between, say, the Hispanic community and the African American community? You see very many differences?
Again, I'm not expert, but, for example, I think the mainly Puerto Rican American and Florida are different from the New York City group, are different from the Mexican American. So even within a group like Hispanic, there's a lot of variety. Mm-hmm. And if you take Native American, there's huge differences in some of the tribal areas. And black, huge differences.
So what implications does this have for cancer prevention efforts?
It's hard to generalize, but I think we want to aim for a common goal. And our board, I had a fellow named Al Haynes on our board of scientific advisors, and I asked him to chair, it was then called Board of Scientific Counselors. He was the president of Drew Medical School in LA. And I didn't realize it when I asked him, but I was told after, he was the first African American to ever chair an NCI advisory group. The point he kept stressing was, we have the same goals as everyone else. We want to reach the same reduction of cancer rates, and we don't want a different goal that's less rigorous, but it's going to cost more to reach it. You need more people. You have to understand they're staff intensive. You have to spend a lot of face time with people, talking with them. So it's a matter of how much investment does it take, how much thinking, how much community participation to really reach the same goal. It takes a lot more effort and costs a lot more.
All right, I want, before we get back to NIH per se, I wanted to just note that in the mid-80s, from 83 to 87, and then in the early 90s, you served on the U.S. National Committee for the International Union Against Cancer. Would you tell me a little bit about this group and what your role was?
I didn't have a big role. At UICC, it's kind of tied to the American Cancer Society. It's an international group, which with mixed quality of what they're trying to do. They mainly try to apply information of cancer control and bring together people in different countries. And usually some of the more advanced Western countries are together and the others are trying to learn from it. We get some training involved. There was one thing, it wasn't quite with UICC, but with WHO, with Dr. Koop. I don't remember who was head of WHO at that time, but WHO had almost no tobacco control in the whole World Health Organization program. So we worked out with Dr. Koop in the lead that we NCR would pay for two people to work in Geneva with the World Health Organization for 2 years, and then they would pick up the cost after that and build a tobacco control program. We did our part, and after the 2 years, they reneged. They didn't do it till they got a new WHO leader from Norway, I think her name was Brent Eklund. I probably have her name wrong, but she built a strong tobacco control. But before that, they didn't have it.
Well, in 1986, Vince DeVita resigned as MCI director and was replaced by Samuel Broder. Would you take just a minute and describe Dr. Broder's leadership style and his goals for the NCI and how cancer prevention fit into those goals?
Sam Broder was very bright. I liked him a lot. I still consider him a friend. He had developed AZT along with the Burroughs, whatever, the company that made it, and did the early testing of AIDS treatment at the clinical center. So I think that gave him the reputation that led him to be NCI director. I think his forte was before that, when he would troop around Building 10, the clinical center, with a lot of fellows, very bright, kind of a good sense of humor, and kind of liked him. I liked him at executive committee. I mean, we would debate things. He had no problem debating. He had this kind of Talmudic logic, mm-hmm. very logical. But he didn't, if you disagree with him, unlike a current guy, no problem, you know, be over after it was over. And everything went well, except then we ran into one problem that I thought he mishandled. And that was in the breast cancer prevention trial with tamoxifen, there was a fellow in Montreal that abused, who was entered into the trial. Essentially, you needed a mammogram after entering the trial for breast cancer prevention. And he put on the trial women that had their exam before the date. And it was discovered by the group in Pittsburgh and reported to NIH, and nothing really happened for 6 months. Then Dingell, the congressman from Michigan, decided to make a big investigation about it. And Sam had trouble standing up to authority. I sort of thought he had, I don't know if his parents, grandparents from the Holocaust, and he just could not handle this aggressive congressman attacking. And so what he did was pass the blame onto Bernie Fisher. And it was a big mess. And I would stand up for Bernie Fisher and say, Sam, why don't you get together and go to Congress together and just say, we had a problem, we took care of it, we're moving forward. And he would be furious with me and say, if you don't like the way NCI is being run, you can resign today. Or you can go to the president and ask him to get my resignation. It happened about 5 times. He would just go off the wall with it. He didn't carry a grudge after, but that's what he said. And then eventually Bernie Fisher sued and won. And what I just said to you is on the legal transcript because they interviewed me. So, but And so, and Bernie knew it. I mean, I would talk to him during this period, and Leslie Ward would say, you know, we're not all your enemies, Bernie, because we thought he was a good guy. But it was very hard, especially on Bernie Fisher's wife and on his head statistician, Carol Redmond, who just could not take it, and she left Pittsburgh for that. And just put all this pressure unfairly on one of the giants, one of the great men in breast cancer research, and that was terrible. If it wasn't for that, I would have said Sam Broder's great. In a way, I miss him, because his style compared to some of the later ones.
Right.
but he would support him. And so I see him now, and once in a while. Wildwood, and he says, now, don't you miss me? You never thought you'd miss me, did you?
I have a few more questions. I'm afraid we're going to run out of tape, as it were, the recording time, but I wanted to try to get through the end of the 80s, and we'll see. We may have to stop abruptly here, depending on how it goes. In 1989, you created the Applied Research Branch to focus on three areas of research: health services and economics, modeling and statistical methods, and cancer risk assessment. Tell me about this branch and who headed it.
Well, that was partly Ed Sondek. I hope it on for years off. He was in that. Larry Kessler, who's later went to the FDA. There were people that were good in that. Martin Brown, who was kind of an economist looking at health services. And they were interested in health outcomes, how you evaluate it, how you use population data, like from the SEER registry, in a very analytical way. And they were world-class. A lot of their work would help groups like Medicare and you know, how do you make policy? They would contribute useful information. That was a strong group. And Rachel Ballard Barbash was part of it and eventually led it. Then under Rick Klausner, it got broken off. He broke our division into two divisions. That's another big issue.
That issue we'll get to in the next interview. The Preventive Oncology Branch, 1991, was, I believe, the branch that led the prostate cancer prevention trial. Tell me about Preventive Oncology.
It actually started way before that, I think 83 or 84. I wanted to start a training program where we would bring people in and train them and build the field for the future. There was an educator, a doctor of education named Robert Burnite, and I, who started setting up a training program where we'd provide a summer course and then set up sort of mentorship for 2 years or so. And we thought it would build a new generation of scientists for cancer prevention. That later we formed into an office, I think, of preventive oncology, which was aimed at training. And it ended up having a summer program with a lot of international people for a month and a half or so, and then a sort of a fellowship program where people would, they'd come already with their doctorate, but then they'd have some extra training for the summer, and then they'd be mentored at all different areas across NCI. The main prostate studies were done under the Community Clinical Oncology Program.
All right, let's step off to the side then and talk about those. I'm sorry I got them under the wrong heading for my questions, but I think this was one of the very important prevention trials you did, and I'd like to hear more about it, especially the fact that you became a subject in it.
Okay, that was the prostate cancer prevention trial. There's a drug called finasteride, or Proscar, that had been developed and used to treat enlarged prostates, obstructive symptoms of urine output, where it would shrink the gland and help. And what it would do is, testosterone is the main male hormone in the prostate. It gets converted to a more potent hormone called dihydrotestosterone, and this drug it inhibits the conversion to the more potent, maybe 10 times more potent male hormone. So we and Merck felt that it might be useful in preventing prostate cancer, and we wanted to set up a trial which we did, which with another cooperative group called SWOG, the Southwest Oncology Group, in the lead. And this trial was aimed at seeing if we could prevent prostate cancer with this drug. Well, when we went to set it up, because black men, African-American men, have the highest rate of prostate cancer, we wanted to oversample. And at the time when we had started the breast cancer prevention trial, we had a hard-boiled hearing in Congress where Bernadine Healy, Leslie Ford, who was worked with me, and I, had to defend why we were giving a drug to healthy women that we knew would have some side effects. And we went and defended it. But now we were going to oversample black men. I knew about Tuskegee or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, we never start a trial unless there's something called equipoise. That is, we don't know the answer. If we knew the answer, we wouldn't do the trial. And you'd have a sort of a balance between what you think and you're not sure. So we were setting up a trial to oversample black men, and we pictured, well, supposing it comes out wrong, how are you going to explain that you oversampled black men and did harm? So the women and younger members of my staff said, no problem, people. Peter, you go on the trial. And if it comes out wrong, you can go to Congress and say, look, I knew the benefits and potential risks, and I did it myself, and so there. So,
brilliant political strategy.
I was one of the 18,000 men that went on. At the end of that 7 years of intervention, no matter what your PSA was, you got a biopsy. So I went through everything, including having my prostate biopsy.
Which wasn't very pleasant, I dare say.
Well, yeah. but it was negative, so far. That's good.
Good. And what about the trial itself? What kind of results?
We showed that we could reduce the occurrence rate of prostate cancer by a quarter, a 25% reduction. So we showed definitively we could prevent prostate cancer. But there was a problem at the time of the report, of the first report of the study, that while those on the drug, finasteride, had a 25% reduction, whether it was clinical disease developed during the 7 years or biopsy results at the end, the ones on the finasteride appeared to have slightly more aggressive cancers. Mm-hmm. There's a grading system called Gleason, mm-hmm. and they had a little more of the higher grade tumors. So that was a problem that we had to understand. As we studied over the past 3 years, it's clear that there's differential shrinkage of the gland by the drug. So the normal tissue shrinks by about a quarter, and the precancerous and cancerous tissue shrinks less or doesn't shrink at all. So you shrink the gland by a quarter, then you put needles in for a biopsy, six, now they use 10 or 12, but we required six, 18-gauge. You're more likely to hit an aggressive-looking part of the gland because the normal part of the gland is shrunk, and just as a matter of anatomy, you'll hit it. So the explanation was a kind of an artifact of diagnosis, and you can estimate from that we actually probably prevented more like 32% of the cancers rather than 25%. So now we have definitive proof that we can prevent at least a quarter of prostate cancer. We're thinking and hoping that the Southwest Oncology Group and the company will bring that through the FDA for approval, because we can't educate the public about it until we get FDA approval. That's where we are today. I'm pretty sure that's going to happen. And then we need an educational campaign.
Which, I want to start today with one broad philosophical question for you then. After the germ theory became so completely established in infectious diseases, the thinking of almost everybody was that there must be a single cause for everything. And, of course, they were looking for the single cause of cancer. Right. Are we back now to a multiple causation? Do we think, I mean, when you say you can prevent 30% or whatever, it sounds like there must be more than one thing that's leading to
it's
these
It's more
cancers.
Than one. And I think of necessary causes and sufficient causes. So necessary, I mean, if you don't have that cause, you won't get the cancer.
Right.
So human papillomavirus and cancer of the cervix.
Yes.
there may be other, probably are other contributing factors. Number of sexual partners, some people even say smoking. There are multiple things that affect the environment and whether you have cancer, hygiene possibly. But if you don't have the virus, you won't get it. So you can prevent it by vaccinating against the virus and then waiting to do it early enough in life before you're exposed.
But that's not true for...
But now you take the diet once. Okay, it's not like tobacco where you smoke or you don't smoke. It's everyone's eating, and it's the relative amounts. And that relative amount probably can affect the microenvironment that allows the tumor to grow or not grow, and it's a very complex issue. So I don't think it's likely we'll have a single cause for some cancers. We will for some, not for others. And there are going to be some that are just part of your normal response to DNA damage, or even if it's from cosmic rays, you know, you can't really prevent it. We're going to have to learn how to deal with it, detect it, treat it. So prevention's a partial answer, a very important one, I think the most important one. I think it's under-supported, but it's not going to be a complete answer, and there's not going to be one cause.
With that, I'm going to stop for today, and thank you very much.
Okay.